Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Truth and Movies, Cruise Control. Today, Panic in Detroit, Catherine Bigelow's hair-trigger tale of the 1967 riots and your worst nightmare, Will Poulter with a gun. Armless fun in Logan Lucky, Soderbergh's slick hick flick, Unpicked. And American Made, Cruise and Lyman's blow-by-blow account of the CIA pilot who put the Contra in Contraband and the Charlie in Half the Eastern Seaboard. Plus Film Club from Lyman to Limey, as we get your thoughts on Soderbergh's 1999 tale of a tea leaf with something brewing. It's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. On board the good ship Truth and Movies this week, we have Manuela Lazic.
Hello.
Hi, Manuela, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
That's great news. Your face is currently adorning billboards all over East London.
That's the other life I lead.
Right. It's nice to have you in our ears as well.
Oh, thank you.
Great. Adam Woodward's here.
Hello.
How are you, Adam?
Good, yeah.
You've been surfing.
Suitably refreshed from my staycation in Cornwall. Yeah.
Nice. Excellent. You visited a seal sanctuary.
I did, yeah. And
we're talking about a seal today, aren't we?
I could feel the link coming.
That's later on, though. Oh, we've had an email here. This is from John Mears. By the way, if you'd like to get in touch, listener, the email address is truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, or you can get us on Twitter @LWLies, or there's the Facebook page. Anyway, John Mears says, Misery and Carrie are great films, because we were talking about Misery last week. Mm-hmm. The Shining, though, says John, is streaks ahead. Yes, Stephen King didn't like it and made a terrible TV movie with a story closer to the original book. But having the source material tinkered with by Kubrick created a superb film. Wonderful performances by all the cast. Terrifying, slow-building plot. Plus, let's not forget how good The Running Man is. Ooh, tails off badly at the end there, John. Is it just me? I actually think The Shining is wildly overrated.
No, I'm with you there. I mean, I like it. I think it's good. I don't think it's anywhere near Kubrick's best.
Mm. What don't you like about it?
I went to a screening of it about 3 or 4 years ago. Down in Brighton, they managed to get over an original American theatrical cut, which had about like 20 minutes more footage on it. So it was like a really long version of the film. And yeah, it was just something I don't think, beyond Nicholson's performance, which is obviously great, I don't think there's like enough there for me to really...
Really?
Latch onto.
That's interesting. Manuela, where do you stand on this?
I only saw The Shining recently for the first time, and... You know, obviously I had a lot of expectations, and when I was little, my mom, she always introduced me to really dark films like Carrie or The Silence of the Lambs, and I was like way too young for this, but she always told me, there's one film I don't want you to see until you're big, and it's The Shining. I was like, okay.
Because it wasn't very good, was that all?
No, because it was so scary.
Oh, right.
And so I watched it, and I was really surprised, because I found myself really terrified, but also just laughing a lot. It's like a really, really dark comedy,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think it's my favorite Kubrick, but I think it's a masterpiece still.
Like, right.
I just think it's so masterful in everything it does.
It does tread a dangerous line between horror and humour. And, you know, certainly the Here's Johnny
My favourite thing is when he has the bat and he says... when she has the bat and he says, stop swinging the bat. And I just thought that's so funny. I know it's horrible because she's scared, but I think it's really good comedy.
All right. I mean, I personally think it's an amazing film. Visually, it's extraordinary. There's all sorts of things that have become iconic from it. You know, the tricycle, the twins, the all work and no play, the barman, all that stuff. It just, the end descends into...
Oh, I love the end.
You like the ending?
So stupid.
That kind of hide and seek in the maze, for me, it just loses. All the pent-up tension is lost at that point.
Great final shot, though.
Yeah.
What's the final shot?
Well, it's the sort of slow pan in on the picture.
Also, before we actually get started, we've got a lot to get through this week. There's some big movies being released. We should just flag up again that Sunday the 17th of September, if you're not busy and fancy a trip down to King's Place in sunny London town, you could join us at the London Podcast Festival. It's Truth and Movies Live. We're on at a crowd-pleasing 9:30pm on the Sunday evening. You can get tickets for our show from the King's Place London Podcast Festival website. Hope to see you there. Right now, though, let's have some drums, and then we'll talk about the first of today's films, Detroit. Yep, Detroit. Catherine Bigelow's film set amongst the chaos of the Detroit riots of 1967, which saw 7,000 arrests and 43 people dying. And this film all about what happens when police and National Guard enter a crowded motel in search of a sniper. This the moment when the policeman played by Will Poulter begins his interrogation.
Now let's not be stupid in this situation. We still have a crime scene here and you're all suspects. Each and every one of you. Don't look at me. Turn around. Face the wall. Was Carl the one doing the shooting? Huh? Somebody better start getting honest with me. Hey! I want that gun!
We looked around. We didn't find a gun.
Doesn't mean it's not here. Go find it. You too! I got nothing against you people. But you need to tell me where the gun is. You need to tell me who was doing the shooting. I'm only gonna ask so many times. Who did the shooting?
We don't know.
All right, Manuela, you didn't sleep after seeing this film.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously the film is very difficult to watch, but then I also couldn't sleep because I kept thinking about what I think of this movie. I've been ruminating on it for so long, and I've talked to a lot of people who saw it, and I'm still not quite sure, but, you know, I have my own theories and my own point of view, and I've heard very different opinions on this movie. So I understand that it's going to be a tricky one for people to talk about.
Well, one of the issues is that the storyline is something that's still very, very actual. The whole issue of Black Lives Matter is something that clearly goes back through this and way beyond this. And that's something that the film sets out very neatly at the start, the whole historical and economic context of what led to the riots and the whole context of the unrest.
Yeah, it starts with like a series of computer-animated panels that were selected from painter Jacob Lawrence's Migration series that he painted in 1940 and 1941, and it's really beautiful. But I do think that it's a bit of a quick summary of a really big problem. Mm. But then I think Bigelow's point was to focus on the specific event and then to like make it as representative of the bigger issue of racism. And now, like, my main issue with the film is that, you know, we could think that it's timely because obviously violence against black people is still very much happening and it's terrible. And, you know, we have this insane president in America who's not going to help with this. But on another level, I've seen people, and I kind of agree with them, saying that in the age of, you know, social media, where we can see actual real people getting shot and people, you know, filming what happens and putting on social media, maybe we don't need a dramatization of this because we know how it is. You know, like we see black bodies being traumatized all the time. So maybe having a dramatization of it on screen for people to watch is a bit of a not necessary.
It's interesting. I would think that it's quite easy because we see these images on social media, on news, it's quite easy for people almost to compartmentalize them or move past them. And they don't really even, a lot of people, unfortunately, emotionally connect with them. And what I think this film did for me remarkably well is in some way give you some glimmer of sense of what it would be like to live under those conditions.
Yeah, I agree very much with this. And that's why I think, you know, I'm a bit on the fence on this one. But I agree that the fact that this movie is very spectacular in its violence, I don't think it's a bad thing. Hmm. I know that some people are saying that this is exploitative, but I think, you know, it's not because you show a real violent event that you are disrespecting it. Hmm. Often it means that you're just trying to make the viewer feel just how horrible it was. And so I think that movie really does that really well. It's horrible. I had like one of the worst times ever watching this movie. So, you know, at the same time, I think it's a worthwhile effort, and I'm glad. Like, I don't want this movie about this horrible event to be palatable. Like, it's not supposed to be a good time. Then again, I don't know if I would recommend it to everybody. And I think Bigelow is very brave to take on this story, because she said that she was offered this story to tell, and she took it on because she felt like it was a story worth telling. And now, obviously, she's getting a lot of heat because of the way she portrayed it, and people are saying that she's exploiting the story. I tend to disagree. I think for the most part, it's kind of like a docudrama where she's just presenting how horrible the events is and are. And that's obviously very hard to watch, but it's the point.
She had a lovely interview in the Guardian last week where she says, is this my story to tell? Am I the person who should be telling this story? Absolutely not. But it's been there for 50 years in the shadows and nobody else has told it. So from that point of view, it's I found it tremendous that she has taken this on.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a hair-trigger film. It feels like it could go off any time, just a wrong word, any time for 2 hours or so, the whole thing can explode.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost unbearably tense in the centerpiece action scene, which takes over the film, really, I guess. I mean, the film initially begins after that opening, which I had a little bit of a problem with that animated opening, as much as it's referencing this incredible piece of artwork. I think the idea of condensing hundreds of years of black oppression in America into that bite-sized. It just didn't really satisfy me. But anyway, moving on to the opening of the film, it starts off with this amazing, I think, ground level exploration of the riot as it's kind of unfolding. And I was a little bit disappointed that it very quickly curtails that and then focuses in on this Algiers motel incident, which it's based on a real account. And ultimately, I think what she's most interested in, and maybe Mark Bowl, the screenwriter, is most interested in, is looking at that and the corruption that was inherent to it. But that scene is, well, I guess we can call it a single scene, right? I mean, it plays out for about 45 minutes or something, but it is a single scene. It is, as I say, unbearably tense and possibly lays it on a bit too thick in terms of not having a lot of nuance as to who the bad guys are and who the good guys are.
Although potentially John Boyega's role is not entirely defined.
Yeah, possibly. I think
he's never a bad guy, though.
No, no. I mean, his role in this is slightly more complex, I think.
The fact that the characters are actually not desperately explored, the exception might be the lead singer of the soul group, the Dramatics. But by and large, whereas there is an attempt to give the city and the social unrest some backstory, the characters are never given any backstory at all. I wondered if that's because, for her, it's not the characters or even Krauss, the kind of sociopathic policeman who are the issue. It's a racist state. So as such, it doesn't matter who the characters are. This is how it plays out. Whichever people you put in there, if you have a society like this, this is what happens.
I agree with that. I just think, at the same time, the film doesn't really tell you anything really about the Detroit riots. Like, it doesn't really provide much in the way of political or social context. I mean, I didn't really come away with a sense of, you know, the film having broadened my knowledge of that subject or that issue.
I feel like she just wanted to let the events speak for themselves. Like, she didn't want to put her spin on racism. She was just presenting a story and being like, look, it speaks for itself. It's horrible and it's absurd. And I think it's also a really difficult story because it's just so damn stupid. But that's because racism is f***ing stupid. And so you just have these people doing insane stuff and it's really hard to watch and it's really upsetting. But that's the point. The beginning, when it shows how the riots first started, like it's like, oh, we just see these people being angry at the police coming over and then leaving, and then they just start destroying their own city. But I wish the film kind of was about that, maybe? About like, what makes you so desperate as to want to destroy your own house, you know, like own shops, your own community. That's like the real sadness here. That's the real hypocrisy of the police then, to come with tanks and be like, oh, we have to clean things up here. People are crazy. They're not crazy. They're desperate and they want you to pay attention. That would have been a great film.
Well, the riot was a huge event. And this was a pretty huge story within that riot. And I guess there are a lot of ways that you could approach trying to tell any of these stories in 2 hours or so, a lot of choices you could have made. Not for the first time, as you mentioned, Mark Boyle and Catherine Bigelow, who've collaborated on this, Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker, have run into huge amounts of controversy over the way that they've approached the subject matter.
I think there's a lot of hot takes out there, and there's an interesting piece that we've run actually where it's not necessarily attacking Bigelow, but it's just stating the fact that she, as a white director or as a white person, does not bring the same perspective as a black filmmaker would. Mm. And I think that is a truthful statement. I don't think you can argue with that. And arguably, she's more interested in the kind of the white system there that was sort of so dominant, and I guess still is. But you see that so much of the police corruption and cover-ups and them covering their tracks, a lot of the sort of behind the scenes or behind closed doors stuff that was going on, which kind of takes you out of the riot itself or the events around the riot. So I didn't necessarily feel that was particularly interesting.
All right. She's got such a diverse body of work. Mm. I mean, you mentioned you watched Point Break the other day, Manuela.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was so amazing. It's become one of my favorite movies ever immediately. It was crazy. I saw a print at the Prince Charles Cinema. And yeah, I think it's...
What did you like most about it?
Well, I think you can tell that it's a female perspective. So the main character is obviously Keanu Reeves, and he's a man. But the way he's shot, like, you can tell that he's a woman. And it's very playful and it's very liberated, and he doesn't really care for realism in some ways. It's very surreal. I like that she's not afraid of making action tough movies, you know, because so many times you have female directors and we're like, oh yeah, they should tell like love stories. And like, no, they can make movies about surfers breaking banks. Like, that's great.
Falling out of planes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Adam, this film then.
Yes.
Detroit. Not an easy watch.
No, intentionally so.
But would you recommend it?
I think it's not necessarily an important film, but one people should probably see, make their own opinions of. I think I would have given this probably a 5 in anticipation, because she is a fascinating director. Mark Boll, her collaborations with him have been very interesting recently. It feels like a very timely film, as you say, and a great cast. So, yeah, 5 for anticipation, and I think 3 for enjoyment and in retrospect. I know it's not a film that you're supposed to enjoy in the moment. Mm. I'd love to say this is a film that I came away wanting to explore further, but actually I found myself thinking more about the merits of it being made in the first place as opposed to what the film is actually trying to say.
Okay. Manuela?
I very much agree with Adam. I didn't enjoy watching this, but I'm glad I didn't. But at the same time, I wouldn't give it, you know, 0 enjoyment, because I think it's doing interesting things as well as disturbing things as well. Like, I didn't walk away from it feeling like, oh, this is something I'm really glad I've seen, or I've learned something here. I just felt brutalized and traumatized. I probably wouldn't recommend this to people I love.
You wouldn't?
No, I would rather they read about the Detroit events. My mom herself, she said, oh yeah, Detroit, I heard about this movie, I read a book about it. And she was saying how horrible it was. And I said, well, don't watch this movie, then you probably know everything there is to know. And yeah, so...
Okay, yeah. I really would recommend it.
Yeah.
I think it's a really powerful bit of... I mean, it's flawed like anything, trying to deal with something this complex and a real-life story as well. It is inherently going to not tick everybody's boxes. And there are undoubted questions about who should be making this and what perspective they bring. But I thought it was an extraordinarily powerful bit of filmmaking, and it left me utterly shell-shocked for the rest of the day. I'd give it 4s across the board. We'll move on, because next up, we're talking about Doug Liman's American Made. American Made, a true story-ish concerning Barry Seal, a former TWA pilot who became the delivery guy for the CIA, the Medellin cartel, and, interestingly, Ollie North. Here's the moment when CIA operative Donald Gleason shows Barry Seal, played by Tom Cruise, a rather exciting spy plane.
CIA owns this?
No. No. Independent aviation consultants.
IAC.
Yeah. You run the company, but after hours you work for us.
Takes pictures?
The work is covert.
Covert.
So anyone finds out about it, family, friends, even Lucy. It's Lucy, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That'd be a problem.
Oh, this is legal?
If you're doing it for the good guys, yeah. Just don't get caught.
Indeed. It is a fascinating story, this. What did you make of the film, Adam?
Yeah, it's one of those stories that it's almost like unbelievable.
You couldn't make it up.
You couldn't make it up. Unbelievable, not for the fact that it did actually happen. Mm. I like it as a sort of character study of this guy who basically, you know, when like a monkey pushes a button and gets a dopamine hit and then just keeps pushing that button. He's like that monkey. You get the sense that he's not really doing it for the cash or for any other kind of reason. His motive is just bizarre in this, because you think there's so many times where you're screaming at the screen being like, stop what you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just because he goes so far.
Yeah.
You've done all you need to do, just kind of walk away.
Mm.
And he doesn't. And I think I find that really fascinating.
I didn't feel the movie was positing that question, why are you doing this? It almost just breezes past it. That I didn't really get much sense of real-world implications for the actions that he was taking. And I think part of the reason for that is Tom Cruise, because it's Tom Cruise. It's Ethan, whatever his name
Ethan
is.
Ethan Hunt.
It's Maverick. And he's doing it all with his cheesy grin. And we never really get behind that.
See, that was initially I wondered, is this just because it's Tom Cruise and this is the performance that Tom Cruise gives in this role? Or actually, was this true to the character? Like, is this his nature? Is that he doesn't really appreciate the kind of bigger picture? And as I say, he is that monkey pressing that button. I mean, that's just my reading, because, as you say, the film totally brushes over that. It doesn't really offer a reasonable motive for him.
Beyond the enormous sums of money.
But then he's not really shown to be. Yes, he kind of upgrades his home and buys himself a new car and keeps his wife happy and everything else. But yeah, he doesn't really ever seem to be in it for the money.
He likes the thrills, I guess.
I mean, so initially when he is introduced as his TWA pilot, he's not introduced as a kind of clean cut all American guy. I mean, he is to an extent, but he's at the point where he's taken a few bungs and he's already smuggling a bit of light narcotics at that point. So he's clearly like a corruptible figure, if not fully, you know, Scarface level. I think as a character study, it's interesting. The film around the character is not so interesting.
Mm.
Like you say, it's done in a very... I found it quite glib, actually, the way it handles his situation.
Right, because the real-world implications of what he's doing, getting involved in the Contras who are trying to overthrow the Sandinistas, importing massive amounts of drugs into America, well, the implications of that, we don't really get a sense of that beyond the fact that this guy's an amazing pilot who can pull off incredible stunts and bends the rules a bit with a smile.
Oh, yeah, it's like there's lots of sexy 80s pilot work in this and him getting to do... Yeah, it's that, like, need for speed thing. It felt like a bit of a tired throwback, actually, to that macho character that we're used to seeing in the 80s. Maybe there's an element there of Cruise doing a sort of self-referential thing, but all the stuff around it, like the fact that he's doing gun running between Central American countries, which are at war with each other, you don't really get a sense of what's actually happening on the ground there and how his actions are affecting people. That's maybe a different film, and this is obviously just going for a kind of light entertainment thing. But
it's quite a privileged position that him and Lyman are taking, essentially, then to just treat this story as, you know, just playing it, not for laughs entirely, but as light entertainment.
Not for laughs, because ultimately, you know, he's not a guy who you should be, like, looking up to or aspiring to or anything like that. He's a guy who kind of takes life by the horns and I guess, rides that bull for as long as he can, I guess. Mm. But at the same time, I don't think he comes across as particularly relatable or likeable.
Mm. It is an entertaining story at heart. So it's not a dull watch.
Oh, no, not at all. I had quite a good time watching it.
Donald Gleeson's really good.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
And there are some really nice moments, most of which are in the trailer, to be fair, although there is one moment with Barry and his wife Lucy in the cockpit, which is brilliantly done, involving a sudden loss of gravity.
Yes.
But by and large, given who the director is, Doug Liman, and given the storyline, I was a little bit disappointed.
Well, his last film, Edge of Tomorrow... I believe that's his last film. Kind of didn't come out of nowhere as such, but was a bigger hit than maybe people were expecting, given that it's a sort of non-franchise, or at the time was a non-franchise big action sci-fi adventure movie. And him and Tom Cruise have formed this interesting sort of partnership now, I think, and long may it continue. I think it's nice seeing Cruise doing something which is a little bit less... I mean, like, what did we... The last
the
Cruise
mummy.
Film reviewed was The Mummy, so... I'd much rather him do something like this than The Mummy, or another Mission Impossible film, which, as much as I love Ethan Hunt, I love that character in those films. it does feel like they've reached at the end of the road with those ones.
Okay. Funny enough, Ollie North and the Iran-Contra scandal involved in this. Doug Lyman's father was Arthur L. Lyman, and he was the chief counsel for the Senate investigation into that affair and actually questioned Ollie North during the public hearings.
Oh, right, there you go. It's meant to be then.
Manuela, you haven't seen this film, which is why.
No.
Are you looking forward to it?
Well, I really like Tom Cruise. I like Tom Cruise in Planes. So yeah. Maybe
I think you'll mostly have a good time.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the first hour or so until maybe it just starts to get a little bit routine for me.
Yeah.
Oh, it's 2 hours long. Oh.
Yeah.
It's a very good bit where he's in this sort of light aircraft and he's got to take off on like a very short runway. And that's the sort of scene where only someone like Tom Cruise could do that scene in the way that he does and make it so funny, I think.
Nice.
Yeah, he's very good in it. I mean, my scores on this would be 4 for anticipation because the trailer looked fantastic. 3 probably at the time because it just started to wear a little bit thin. And maybe 2 in retrospect. Adam?
I think I'd go 3-3-2.
Okay.
That's a sort of a high 2.
Okay.
Because I don't think it does anything particularly bad or wrong. You know, it's competently made.
Also, it's not the kind of film that you see for the post-score. It's the 3 at the time. It's perfectly decent.
If I never see this film again, I won't be too sad about that.
Okay, there you go, listeners. Up next, we've got a film that has been wowing the critics, also coming out this week in the UK and I suspect worldwide. It is the new one from Steven Soderbergh, Logan Lucky.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Logan Lucky. Two brothers from the famously unlucky Logan family plot to turn their fortunes around by robbing a NASCAR race in Charlotte, North Carolina. Here's the bit where the brothers meet their explosives expert, Joe Bang, played by Daniel Craig.
I got 5 months to go in here. I should probably lay low a bit before doing a job.
This has to happen in 5 weeks.
I am incarcerated.
Yeah, we got a plan to get you out.
Isn't break me out?
Yep.
In the middle of the night?
No. Afternoon. It's a day job.
You're gonna get me out of here in broad daylight, do the job, and then get me back in here before you know what notice is?
Yep.
You Logans mustn't be as simple-minded as people say.
People say that.
Manuela.
Yes.
So you got a plot, and a very convoluted plot, to rob a large sum of money involving a great lineup of actors. It sounds a little bit like something Steven Soderbergh's done before this.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like the Ocean's trilogy. But in a way, it's quite different in its setting and in the type of people it concerns itself with. So it's more, in the Ocean's trilogy, it was more like high-flying, like really cool, smooth people like George Clooney. And here it's more kind of lower-class people in West Virginia trying to make it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite different. So that sounds nice, but I'm afraid to say I did not like this movie very much.
This has got great reviews.
I know.
I don't think I saw a review that wasn't really good for this film.
Oh, I saw some.
Did you?
I'm not alone here.
And you're about to give one of your own.
Well, yeah.
What didn't you like about it?
I found it quite loose. I found that the story was, on paper, amazing. Mm-hmm. And really, I love a convoluted story with a weird twist and, you know, interesting, mysterious people. But I think, as a film, it didn't really work. It felt like it wasn't tight enough. There was a lot of filler. Filler in the sense of, you know, exposition shots and setting the scene and all that. But at the same time, the characters were not convincing. The film was trying to spend time presenting them as real personalities, but I didn't buy it. I just didn't buy it. And so in the end, I just didn't really care. And I could follow, but I just was like, why am I watching this?
Didn't care. So. Adam, Soderbergh had said previously, because he hadn't made a film in 4 years, so kind of semi-retired from cinema. He was making The Nick, which you're a big fan of.
Yeah.
He said, I've lost interest in anything that smells important. What does that mean about what he's trying to do here?
Well, Steven Soderbergh is an interesting one in that he's been making movies for the best part of 30 years now, I think.
Really?
Yeah, Sex, Lies and Videotape, obviously. He's like the original Sundance kid that came out and blew up in the 90s. And his semi-retirement, or hiatus now, I guess, as we can call it, is, I think, was the result of his growing frustration with the industry, and that it's essentially impossible to make a movie for grown-ups from an original screenplay that isn't part of like a franchise or isn't a superhero movie, isn't full of like endless action and violence and sex. And in fact, this film, I think, has something like 3 swear words in it, and there's none of that stuff that I just mentioned in here. So it's, in a way, a bit of a gamble of a film to make, I suppose. But yeah, I think he's just attracted to the screenplay by Rebecca Blunt, which I think I'm right in saying it's her first ever screenplay.
Whoever she is, because there's a lot of suggestion in the States that she doesn't actually
that
exist.
That is actually him. Yeah, yeah, I'm intrigued by that. I think that's like a nice idea, like a nice fantasy that people probably want
to... Well, no one's ever seen her or met her. That's, I mean, none of the people have tried to get in touch with her.
Right. Maybe it's a marketing thing.
Possibly so.
Yeah, yeah. Although interestingly, like, I don't know why he would do that if it wasn't a film written by him, because he's made films that he's written the screenplays for before.
Right.
And he's famously, you know, one of the reasons he kind of went on this self-imposed hiatus is that he likes to have creative control. So these days he kind of edits, shoots his own movies. I wouldn't be surprised if it was him that had actually written it, but I don't see why he wouldn't have just been open about that initially.
Maybe it was actually written by Akiva Goldsman and they just didn't want anyone to know he did the last Transformers movie.
Oh, poor Akiva Goldsman.
All right, did you like it?
This is one of my favourite movies of the year, I'm pleased to say. So sorry, Manuela.
That's
so
fine.
Why did Manuela, and I got to admit, why did we completely miss the boat on this one?
Well, I don't know to what extent you missed the boat. I think
Explain
actually,
my brain to me.
It's interesting that you said the stuff with the characters, the kind of expositional stuff, was what you didn't like, because I thought that was what really made it for me. I think the Ocean's movies, they lack that sense of character and purpose and motivation. And I mean, the stuff with Channing Tatum and his daughter, apparently when they were doing test screenings for this film, that was actually one of the piece of feedback they had, was that he wanted to include more of those scenes, and they actually went back and wrote a few more of those scenes in.
Right.
And I love that sort of sense of everyday connection and relationship. There's a beautiful scene early on where he's telling this story about his favourite John Denver song, and it's clearly it's a story that we're hearing for the first time, but the daughter's heard like 100 times before, and she just hangs off every single word. And I just love the little simple moments between the characters.
Producer Tom was just mentioning the fact that this is actually the 4th film that we've had of late with John Denver in it, and the use of it in this film, I think, is one of the nicer moments for me of the film. Mm. Take Me Home, Country Roads is the song in this film. Annie's song turns up in...
In Okja.
Is it in Okja?
Yeah.
And in Alien Covenant?
Apparently.
And also in Free Fire.
Yeah.
And not desperately well used, I didn't think there, but then I wasn't a massive fan of Free Fire.
This is the best use of Denver, I think, yeah. This year.
I quite like him in Lockjaw. I think it's really funny. And.
But what's with all this John Denver revival?
I don't know.
He's having a moment.
It's a nice song.
Yeah, he's having a moment, isn't he?
It's a great song.
Yeah. I love that start as well. For me, the issue was that when the movie began like that, I thought, we're going to have an actual story told with a bit of heart and soul here. But instead, what we ended up with was a kind of a fluff, a caper flick in which he does what he does so well, but he can almost do it in his sleep. We'll have a convoluted cast of characters. They'll do some vaguely hokey stuff. There'll be some comedy twists, but we're laughing with them, not at them too much. And above all, we'll have a plot that is extraordinarily convoluted, as I say, couldn't possibly take place, but everything just falls into place. So there's no tension at the end. There's no great sense of danger. And for a heist film, for a movie which leaves much of the family stuff behind to concern itself with the heist, for there to be a total absence of any feeling of tension or danger about whether the heist is going to come off or not is pretty unforgivable.
I think that the heist stuff isn't necessarily the most important thing, though. I mean, the stakes are kind of purposely kept quite low, I think. It's a film which he could have made in his sleep, as you say. I think only someone like Steven Soderbergh could make a film like this, because it is, I think, quite intentionally loose. The way that the heist is kind of plotted out and put together, and the way that ultimately it's revealed how certain things were done towards the end.
He does that thing. He did this in Ocean's 12 as well.
Yeah.
He goes back and explains the punchline to a joke that you weren't even, he never really told you in the first place.
Oh, I think all that stuff's amazing.
Do you think so?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's so simple and yet so difficult at the same time, I think, to do that in a really cohesive, really beautifully straightforward way. I just think it's such a wonderfully humane film, and this is a setting, I guess, and a group of people who we're not used to seeing that much on screen. And it could have quite easily have been a mocking of them. It's a culture which is very different, I guess, to, I mean, America's so diverse, obviously, but it's a culture that American culture we're so not used to seeing, and one which is often mocked. The idea of the kind of slack-jawed hick yokel type is a bit of a trope in cinema now.
Right.
And I love the way he kind of, not so much subverts it, but just shows it for what it is. And it's such an affectionate portrayal of that culture, and it's such a singular culture.
Yeah, you look beyond the kind of cliche a bit. Mm. But it's very Coen Brothers. Many people have said this is like the Coen Brothers did Ocean's 11. It's kind of got a little bit that feel to it, which sounds better than I personally found it. But this clearly divides people down the middle. You loved it. David Jenkins loved it. He gave it 5 in his review on Little White Lies. Manuela, you and I just got left behind by it. We were in a screening yesterday where Steven Soderbergh and Adam Driver turned up at the start, actually.
That was great.
Said, that was quite exciting. But I don't know where you were sitting, because my side of the auditorium didn't laugh, and the other side of the auditorium really enjoyed it. I mean, clearly thought it was tremendously humorous. There's an extended sequence involving a kind of riff about Game of Thrones, which kind of underlined to me the fact that this film thinks it's way funnier than it actually is. I didn't find many belly laughs. There are some chuckles in there, but...
Yeah.
I don't know how much I laughed out loud during the film, but I think I had a smile on my face like the whole way through.
Well, that's good.
You know that thing where you're sat in a movie and you just know that you're in the hands of like a really, really bloody good filmmaker.
Yeah, it's nice when that happens.
And it doesn't really, for me, it feels like it doesn't happen often enough. And when it does, I'm just quite happy to sit there knowing I'm in safe hands. I'm not really too bothered about where they're taking me.
It's a great feeling that when you sit down and you think, I'm going to enjoy this film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I haven't had that with all of his films, I've got to say. There's a few from his back catalogue which I don't get on with. And there's some of his more recent ones as well, actually. But this I just think is so simple, so beautifully realised. And just a quick shout out to Daniel Craig, who I was going to actually say he's the first voice that we hear in that clip earlier, because it just, you wouldn't know it's him basically just from listening to that.
Actually, you forget you're watching.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it's very sad that he's now signed up to do another Bond film. Because
did you see the credits at the end? It says, and introducing Daniel Craig as Joe Bang. And you're like, oh.
As much as I think he's decent as Bond, and I don't want to get too much into this, but watching this, you're like, he's having so much fun making this movie.
He's
and
a terrific actor.
When you watch him in Bond, he's clearly not enjoying it. I know he's getting paid a lot of money.
Well, you hesitated for a bit, you see.
Do you know what it's like? It's like Barry Seal. He just can't stop pushing. He's that monkey pushing a button.
He is that monkey, yeah.
What numbers do you give this, Adam? You going with David's five?
Oh, I'm fives across the board, yeah. The first five for the fact that he hasn't made a film in such a long time, and I do think he's a vastly underappreciated American filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sort of film I wanted to watch as soon as it had finished again.
Really?
Yeah.
Manuela.
I definitely was anticipating this, so five. Yeah, I love him. For me, Sex Lies and Videotape is a masterpiece. It's one of my favorite movies. I watch it all the time. But enjoyment, I'd say three. In retrospect, I would say probably like 2.5.
Yeah.
I don't want to watch this again. It's a shame. It's a shame. It had all the ingredients.
Yeah, I'd very much subscribe to your numbers there. This is very much an Ocean's 12 as opposed to a Limey or something like that. Hey, speaking of which, well, Adam, there's something you wanted to add at this point, I think.
I was just going to give a quick shout out to the fact that we've got an interview with Steven Soderbergh going on the website this week. I think it'll probably be live on Thursday.
Brilliant.
And yeah, it's interesting what he says in it. He talks a lot about his frustrations with the industry and the fact that he's got this new distribution model, which he's sort of using this film as a trial for. And essentially it involves him selling all the distribution rights ahead of even making the film. And essentially getting the funding that way and then making it on a pretty small, I think it cost something like $30 million, which is, not a lot by today's standards. So interestingly, the film, even though it's been critically acclaimed, hasn't done amazingly well in the States. I don't think his opening weekend was pretty modest. But what's really interesting is he talks about where the film has done well. And he talks about marketing the film to specifically those depicted in the film and those kind of southern states. Apparently, they were some of the lowest attendances they had were in those states. So, there's an interesting... Yeah, which... apparently they really targeted those people and actually LA and New York and another kind of bigger city folk, they weren't really so worried about. I guess maybe they knew that they were more likely to turn up because maybe they're more review driven or something. But he did seem a bit disappointed by that, whether it will eventually get word of mouth or whether there's like a suspicion amongst those people that it's a Hollywood film depicting their culture in a negative light. Yeah, he is. He is sort of from that region. So,
well, when he turned up prior to the screening that we saw Manuela, he was sort of almost pinning his hopes on a good reception in the UK because we care more about movies.
Yeah, he said he looked quite anxious, but in a good way, and quite happy to be there. And he said, "Oh, it's always nice to come to the UK because you guys really have a passion for movies that is a bit getting lost in the US." Mm. And I was like, "Oh, well, always he always has something to say about the industry and the audiences and stuff."
Absolutely. Well, a lot of his films don't do that well at the time, but are still critically hailed, and we'll be looking at a fine example of that in our film club right after this. Yes, it's the Little White Lies Film Club. Every week we go back and look at something and ask you to do the same. And generally we try and tie in with either a listener suggestion or something that's just come out. In this case, Logan Lucky, Steven Soderbergh. And we picked one of the classics from his back catalogue, 1999's The Limey, starring Terence Stamp.
When I was in prison, second time, tell a lie, third stretch. Yeah, third. There was this screw what really had it in for me. And that geezer was top of my list. 2 years after I got sprung, I sees him in Holland Park. He's sitting on a bench feeding bloody pigeons. There was no one about. I could have gone up behind him and snapped his f***ing neck. Wallop. But I left it. I could have nobbled him, but I didn't. Because what I thought I wanted wasn't what I wanted. What I thought I was thinking about was something else. I didn't give a toss. It didn't matter, see? This Burke on the bench wasn't worth my time. It meant sod all in the end, because you've got to make a choice. When to do something and when to let it go. When it matters and when it don't. Bide your time. That's what prison teaches you, if nothing else. Bide your time and everything becomes clear and you can act accordingly.
Manuela, for anyone who didn't catch up with this film, what happens in it?
So it's quite a simple story. It's an English criminal, played by Stamp, who travels to Los Angeles to investigate the death of his daughter.
And the rather shady record producer she's been hanging around, played by Peter Fonda.
Excellent casting choice to have him play a record producer from the 60s who's kind of disillusioned about the 60s. It's beautiful.
There's a lot of interesting choices that Soderbergh made back in 1999 when he put this film together. the editing, which is very singular, jumping from one time frame to another, even in the midst of a sentence.
It's the best editing I've seen in so long, and I was completely blown away. Like, I just couldn't believe it.
Well, I just wanted to read out a comment from Hemen Shafei, who says, first time I'd ever noticed how important editing can be to the film experience, which is interesting because that clip that we've just listened to, when you hear that monologue and when you actually see it, it's sort of cut up quite a lot. They must have taken, I don't know how many takes they did of it, but it must have been like 10 or 12 takes or something of him doing it. It sounds like a single piece there, but actually the way it's edited and framed is really fascinating, I think. Even though I saw this film for the first time for this very film club, it's a really amazing piece of editing that, yeah, I wish I'd have seen it earlier, actually.
The very opening scene is just, it's really hard to describe because it mixes together different timelines, different people, different things that are happening. And it's all kind of in silence. Mm. And it's so sad. And it's kind of about grief and the mourning of Terrence Stamp for his daughter. And it's just the most amazing editing I've ever seen. Everybody, please watch this movie. It's life-changing.
Well, lots of people have, of course, watched it. Scott McKay, for example, mesmerising performance from Terrence Stamp. Brilliant use of vintage footage, one of my all-time favourite movies. The vintage footage is another interesting choice from Soderbergh. The scenes from Ken Loach's debut movie, Poor Cow, made back in 1967, which features a young Terrence Stamp and a very poignant set within the context of this film of a man at the other end of his kind of story arc. Mm. He didn't have the easiest time getting hold of that footage, though.
Yeah, the sort of story goes that Steven Soderbergh approached Warner Brothers, who had the rights for Poor Cow, and requested its use, and they basically said, no, you can't have it. And his response was, well, I'm never going to make a film for you ever again. And I think the executive soon retreated on that and said, OK, do what you want with it.
What else have we got, Manuela, from our bulging post bag?
So we have William Gibson.
William Gibson.
Yes, himself, the cyberpunk author and writer of one of the many early iterations of Alien 3.
Mm. I'm sure that's what he wanted on his gravestone.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty good, I mean. He says, unforgettable, third act is less than perfect, but the first two are sheer genius.
Wait, so this is William Gibson, that William Gibson who's writing into us or to Little White Lies' Twitter feed?
Yeah.
Blimey. All right.
There's also Friday Jones, who says, I worked on the film poster as a young designer in LA. The directive was Saul Bass, and I've had a love affair with him ever since.
Right.
And it is a really beautiful poster.
It's lovely, isn't it? Well, there's two that I've seen, and they're both gorgeous.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. Who's Saul Bass, then? I feel like I should know that name.
He's like the most famous movie poster. He did all of like Hitchcock's.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so like the Vertigo poster and stuff.
Well, one of these is very Hitchcock-y.
Yeah. Ian Gilchrist here. Says, love it. Makes a great double bill with Point Blank, which is another really cracking neo-noir, one of my favourites. He also says, I saw Stamp, Terrence Stamp, near the BFI some years ago and wanted to shout across the street at him, tell them I'm effing coming.
Jimmy, Happy Boy Price, says, I had the chance to meet Stamp once. He lit up. Not a cigarette, I presume. He lit up when I mentioned how much I loved The Limey. His best film, ? Oh, it's interesting, though, because the way that Soderbergh has him in this movie, a lot of it is, it's almost like cartoony Cockney. Mm. It's almost like he deliberately asked him to overact, and especially in the early scenes. And I wonder what Soderbergh's trying to do there. And also what Soderbergh's, is this character where Basher in the Ocean's films comes from? Because Soderbergh obviously takes so much delight in having him say things like tea leaf, china plate, Barney rubble, butcher's hook.
Well, apparently he initially had Michael Caine in mind for the role.
For this role,
yeah. Really? Which is surprising given the sort of Poor Cow stuff that there is as well in there. Mm. You'd think he'd written it with Terrence Stamp in mind. But I think if it had been Caine, it would have almost been like too much of a nod to the Cockney archetype, which Caine obviously was so famous for. Mm. But yeah, I think this is probably Stamp's best performance.
He's really good here. I really like him in Fiorema. Teorema, the Pasolini movie, but it's very different. It's much more subdued performance style.
Where would you rank this among Soderbergh's films?
I watched it for the first time for this podcast as well, but I think it's absolutely amazing. It's not my favourite. My favourite is still Sex, Lies and Videotape, as I said, but it's really up there. Probably second or third.
He's made some great films over there. I mean, Traffic, that was a fantastic film.
Yeah, Out of Sight, which he did.
Out of Sight, yeah.
The Lime is one of those that's always been on my long list of things to see, and for whatever reason, I've never got around to it, and I'm now kicking myself because just on first viewing, I think it might be one of my like favourite films ever. I mean,
really?
it ticks so many boxes for me. And it's also just an amazing deconstruction of certain tropes, and especially like the kind of masculinity that filmmakers since have unpicked, and to a lesser extent, I think it's easily as good as anything like Paul Thomas Anderson was making in the 90s. And yeah, it's just got this amazing tonal quality to it that you don't see anymore. I mean, you do not see films like this being made anymore, quite simply.
Grendel says, Aristotelian movement of spirit was perfect. Main characters, reversal recognition, sublime and subtle. Yeah, nicely put, Grendel. And Ashley Clark, our pal Ashley from New York.
Yeah, he writes in to say, wry, poignant, tense and impeccably cast. It boldly melds and easily transcends the trappings of two 90s genres that were overcooked almost as soon as they began, which are the violent Tarantino-esque thriller and the Cockney gangster gadabout. So that's basically what I wanted to say in more eloquent terms.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that is an interesting point, arriving in sort of 99, when basically the point at which a lot of this stuff, like, I don't know, I guess the Cockney gangster gadabout stuff is maybe where Guy Ritchie and those guys come into the mix. But certainly in terms of American cinema, like Tarantino, there were so many imitations of his work at that point. And this, I don't know how much it's like intentionally trying to subvert that or reference that. It doesn't necessarily fit into that category in a neat way for me. It kind of is a bit of an outlier to that. But
I think he's reflecting on other things,
totally,
maybe
yeah.
more than other movies. I like what Ashley said here as well about there's an inverted plot reference to the 1984 Stamp starring thriller The Hit. I don't know if you ever saw that, Manuela.
I did.
I really
I
enjoyed
love
that
this
film.
Movie. It's so beautiful. It's Stamp and John Hurt. It's everything.
And Tim Ross.
That's true.
We should do The Hit.
Yes.
Because that was slated at the time when it came out, but I really enjoyed it. A film with kind of metaphysical ambitions, which I think did it no good at the box office. Ashley then goes on to say, think of the spooky connections between the characters played by Melissa George here and in David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, with which it shares a locality. Who is Melissa George in this film?
Yeah, so Melissa George in this, she plays his daughter Jenny,
right,
who we only actually see in sort of hazy flashbacky sequences and in photographs, so she doesn't really actually appear in the film beyond that. I think that's an amazing observation from Ash. And Terrence Stamp, I mean, it is his movie. I mean, he totally owns it, and we talk about the quotable lines of dialogue and the monologue, and I think what's so great about his performance is just that it could easily be a kind of one-note, hard man, geezer role. And he does something very subtly, does something with it that just makes it so much more layered and nuanced than that. I think he wears so much of the character's past and internal conflict just on his face, just his expressions, the way he kind of carries himself. It is a wonderful piece of casting. And then you've got Peter Fonda as well, of course.
Oh, he's so
pretty terrific in this. Excellent. Hey, what are we going to be doing in next week's film club?
We've had a suggestion in, actually, from Lynn Raymond, who says, with the passing of Jerry Lewis, how about discussing The King of Comedy, which is, in her opinion, Scorsese's best film.
So will you please give your warmest greetings to the newest King of Comedy, Rupert Pupkin.
His name is Rupert Pupkin. He lives in a world of make-believe.
Oh, Jerry, I love this guy. Always coming up with these great lines. I love him. I love him.
Nobody can remember his name.
Mr. Pupkin.
Mr. Pupnik.
Mr. Puffer.
Rupert.
Pupkin, P-U-P-K-I-N.
But by 11:30 tonight, the whole world will know that Rupert Pupkin is the new King of Comedy. Robert De Niro. Jerry Lewis. In a Martin Scorsese picture. The King of Comedy.
Jerry Lewis, who passed away this week, a lot of his early comedies, which obviously he's so famous for, they're maybe not as easy to watch and get hold of. So The King of Comedy is a good shout. I think it's one which maybe people aren't as familiar with in the Scorsese oeuvre. Definitely one of Lewis's finer later roles.
Mm. And De Niro, you've got De Niro in
and
there as
De Niro,
well.
Kind of playing against type a little bit.
Mm. I recall it as a challenging film, but it was wildly received. I mean, so well received at the time.
Yeah, and I think that even now it's considered. We did a ranking piece of all Scorsese's films, and I think it was in the top three or four. Yeah, definitely one that people point to now as one of his best works.
All right, well, that was Lynn Raymond out of Santa Fe, New Mexico. So thanks for that, Lynn. Do let us know your thoughts on that film so we can incorporate them in next week's show by emailing us at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or on the Facebook page Little White Lies or Twitter LW Lies. Manuela, anything else you'd like to mention before we shut up shop for another week?
Just to give my two cents on The King of Comedy, it is a great film, so please everybody watch it. I think it's probably one of De Niro's most interesting performances because he plays a really unbearable person. So have a great time with that one.
Excellent. Adam?
Nothing from it. I'm off to go and rewatch The Limey, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And Logan Lucky, by the sound of it.
Yeah, back to back.
What else are we doing in next week's show in terms of new releases, Adam?
We've got God's Own Country.
Okay.
And a film called Patty Cakes.
About the rapper.
About a rapper.
Right.
A white female teenage rapper.
Cool. All right, well, listen, listener, thank you for being with us. We'll be back next midweek. Hopefully you'll be joining us then. In the meantime, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.